I'll get started. So if you're well aware, renewables under the Trump era, so you're in the right place if you wanted to learn about that. My name is Stephanie Sow. I'm an energy reporter for an organization called S&P Global. It's after the Standard & Poor's brand. We do compete with Bloomberg and a number of financial news, data-driven type publications. We basically write about certain sectors, including energy, and I'm on the renewables energy team. So in the beginning, I just wanted to, we have a bunch of solar speakers and some wind representatives, and I also have a utility here who is one of two largest utilities in Michigan. It's good to pick one that is very diversified in generation, has some traditional generation in addition to moving, changing itself into renewables. I will move it on, and each speaker will speak about 10 minutes in terms of some housekeeping items. Just keep questions to the end, you know, jot them down. In terms of, I think we're all aware, but journalists and SEJ members get to ask questions first at the end. I don't think we've had a problem. We're a rather small group, but we'll have the last half hour for Q&A for members, okay? And let me just get started with a few recorders here. One second. Okay. All right. And our first speaker today is the gentleman to my left, Dan Witten, who's a representative of the Solar Energy Industries Association, a national association representing solar companies.
Yeah, thank you, Stephanie, and hi, everybody. Thrilled to be here. And we booked the smallest room so we could look popular. My 7 years of PR are really paying off. Stephanie asked me to speak a little bit more from the utility scale angle for solar to try to provide a little bit of basic education on utility scale. I hope it's not too basic. My colleague Lauren Randall will represent rooftop much more capably than I can represent utility scale. So I'll leave most of that to her. First, broadly, we're at 47 gigawatts now. Can't remember the home equivalent, but it's about 10 million homes equivalent. Oh, 9.1 million homes equivalent, right. I inflated it just a little bit, like any good PR person would. So our annual growth rate's 68%, which is pretty great. Now, as you go back over the last 7 years, you might have 1,000%, 900%, 500%, 100%. And the bigger you get, the harder it is to grow by percentages. So looking ahead, absent the trade case that I'll get into, we think we'll about triple in the next 5 years. So continued growth in solar, and the reason is because we've become cost competitive. Again, something that will be left to question based on this trade case. But it's really our ability to compete in markets with other fuels and provide customers an opportunity for their own choice that they can see. They know that they can actually affect their own bills that has led to our growth and continued growth. We employ 260,000 people, as you can see, and we had a nice campaign last year about being a million solar strong. By next year, again, pending this trade case, we could hit 2 million. So that's that slide. It's just great to be part of this growth story. As I mentioned, it's directly tied into prices. So you see prices going down and growth going up. It's pretty basic. It really is. I think, you know, 10, 15 years ago, people felt like they wanted to go solar because they wanted to make a difference. Now they want to go solar because they can save money. And that's how you make it in this world. So we're proud to be part of the conversation in real choices for energy sources. So yeah, talking a little bit about utility scale. You know, obviously, utility scale is much more successful where you have, you know, a lot of land. Some of the issues there is in permitting. It's not unlike other industries, other energy-producing industries. And so one of the things that the utility-scale sector has been able to do is lease land off of private citizens, farmers, and really provide revenue for those people where they weren't getting revenue before. The tax base has been a big deal, and that's why we have so much support for utility scale in states like North Carolina, second biggest solar state now, because there's plenty of land. It's bringing in revenue. We're getting a ton of support from Republicans and Democrats alike, and it's now become, you know, part of what they're willing to fight for. And that's really been important in Republican states across this country. A utility scale accounts for anywhere between 60 and 70% of the capacity, depending on the year. It's just, you know, it gets easier to build these big projects and hook them up to the grid. And again, they're really making a difference in how our country uses electricity, and we expect that to continue.
Just explain, does anybody not know what utility scale is or examples of them? If you just raise your hand if you don't know. Okay, most people know. Okay, it's large solar, even on, I think it includes community gardens and things like that, right? Utility scale can include?
That's kind of the middle ground. Many of the community solar are kind of smaller utility, sort of localized distributed generation also. It varies on that. Okay. So the trade case. This is something that came up. We sort of knew about it in early April. It was initially filed April 26th. And because we've been through trade cases before, we knew right away that this was going to be a big deal. As filed, the petition would cut new solar projects, projected solar projects, by two-thirds. It would more than double the cost of solar panels. It would cut our workforce by a third, by 88,000 jobs. You can see the squiggly line there are the projects that don't get built. The orange line there is the jobs that we have to terminate or end, or, you know, just, you know, can't keep people employed if the original proposal went through. Now, it's really fast moving. I've been joking that every 8 hours I have to write a new set of talking points because things are changing so fast. And just for a little bit of background, there are three phases to it. There was an injury phase. We felt that the companies that filed did not deserve to get an injury finding. They're poorly run. They did not compete in the utility scale sector, the fastest growing sector in the country. Companies like Sunrun and others had problems getting the quality of product that they needed out of these companies. And so they weren't able to compete even in the area where they wanted to compete, and they had some really bad management issues. So we felt there were a lot of things these companies did that brought injury on themselves, aside from imports. And just to take a quick step back, you know, obviously this is an international trade case. It deals with imports from every single country in the world, and it would apply tariffs and or quotas to all imports. We lost on injury on September 22nd. Not that I have all these dates committed to memory. I dream of whatever the next date is, unfortunately. But so we move on. And the next phase, in the second phase is where we are, is a remedy phase where the International Trade Commission decides what remedy is appropriate. And our point of view is that these companies need extraordinarily high tariffs beyond what's legally permitted, or horrendously low quotas to the point where they're destroying half the demand for solar just to survive, even if they can. So what you're doing is you're basically detonating jobs, you're killing an industry, and two small bankrupt foreign-owned companies might survive. So we feel they're exploiting U.S. trade laws to get a bailout. The International Trade Commission will make a remedy recommendation to the president on November 13th. The president then has 2 months to implement a policy with regard to tariffs. You can go to the next slide. I probably already covered it. Okay, well, no, that's a good one. I like that one. So, you know, one of the things that this panel is meant to do is to talk about renewables in the age of Trump, and it has been an enormous part of our strategy. You know, in this room, I hate to say it, but we're all Republicans. If you're working in advocacy, the Republicans have the White House, they have the Senate, they have the House of Representatives, they've got every agency. So we need to be able to talk to them on bipartisan terms, but certainly on their terms. It's just you don't get anything done if you fight them before you even walk in their office. And make no mistake that, you know, the ITC still has this case. We're meeting with administration officials every single week. It's critical that we get in there and make our case, because this is a pro-business case. This is not an environmental case. I mean, it may be for some people an environmental case, but for Washington advocacy groups, it's about business. So, no, I'm not done. I love this side. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, and I'll speed through the rest of them, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the way we think about campaigns. I think 10 years ago, you know, it was like, oh, we got to get good media coverage. Let's hire big firms to help us get media coverage and convince reporters that we have a story. We've actually got five different lines of attack here. And even within the communications function, we've got five different lines of attack. So, you know, the legal fight is with the ITC, external affairs. We've been able to make friends with the Heritage Foundation, with ALEC, with groups that never would have supported industry. And they're doing op-eds, they're contacting reporters. They're as angry about this as we are. And so that's been the external affairs function has been critical. Research, I could spout off numbers all day long because we've looked at all this stuff. We've got top-notch researchers both internally and externally that are looking at this and providing data for us. Obviously, lobbying. We got more than 80 members of Congress to send a letter to the ITC saying this is a bad deal. And again, regular White House visits, it has to happen. And then communications, I probably don't need to go into that as much. You guys know what that is. But just on the communications front, I think one thing that Trump has been, you know, unbelievably good at, and we all know this, is he communicates directly to his audience through social media. And this has been something that journalists are having to deal with now, is that there's a lot of different ways for us to get our message out. Bottom line for us is journalists are as important as ever. But for some corporate groups, you know, they're getting their message out through their own investments in social media and in reaching the public through advertising. And so journalists and news stories are one avenue. And I think Trump is doing what we all knew, you know, we all know about communicating directly and going around the media filter and all that. But he's done it exceptionally well. And more and more, I think people will follow his approach to getting his message out. So next slide. I think I'm pretty much... Okay, so I mentioned the letter. We can move on. That was really important in terms of getting interest in our case. This one, again, solar panel prices have gone down. Manufacturing jobs have gone up. The other side is making this about American manufacturing, red, white, and blue. They're not American companies, and they will kill manufacturing jobs. Next.
This is the last slide.
And that's it. Lauren?
Right on.
Okay, which is
Just in case, there's a lot of data and numbers. We will post the slides, so if you didn't catch everything, you know, we will get it to it. Okay, so we'll now turn to a solar rooftop company with Lauren.
Great. Thank you, Dan. That was a great overview. Happy to be here with you all this morning. I'm still on California time, so I'll try to be perky. A little bit about me. So I'm a director of public policy now at Sunrun. I'll go into kind of the stats of Sunrun. Started my career with Environment America in D.C. Most recently then was with Sierra Club. So I've worked with many of you in that capacity. And we'll just say I strongly, strongly believe at this point in our democracy, you are doing some of the most important work. So really pleased to be here today. So Sunrun, nice picture of our, I think, San Diego community. Sunrun is the largest dedicated residential solar storage and energy services company in the U.S. We now have about 13% market share of rooftop solar. We are getting to about 150,000 customers across the country in 22 states in D.C. and employ directly 3,000 people in the U.S. through our partners and subcontractors, employ closer to 11,000 people. So big operation that has been around for about a decade now. Our founders, Ed and Lynn Jurich, founded the company in 2007, right out of their graduate school. And they were actually the first to pioneer the solar as a service model. So that's allowing homeowners to pay zero down, have a 20-year lease, and essentially making it much more accessible and affordable for people who want to invest in rooftop solar. All right. So I thought I'd put this up there. No matter who our president is, I firmly believe we are moving towards a clean energy future. The headline I read this week from the Associated Press is that solar was the fastest growing form of energy globally last year. It accounted for 2/3 of new net energy capacity that came online. About a half of that came from China. So it's the direction that we're moving. I think, you know, part of that, of course, is in the name of cleaner air. Oh, man, you're messing up my nice picture. No problem at all. Welcome. Part of that, you know, is a call for, of course, cleaner air in a lot of these countries. And then from our end, what we think about from the rooftop solar is this is a very consumer-driven trend. It is people wanting cleaner, more affordable energy, having more control over that. I think in light of recent news as well, it's waking up to our weather is only getting more extreme. This trio of hurricanes that have devastated the southern part of the United States and Puerto Rico are, I think, a real slap in the face showing us that. And one thing I've been thinking about as you look at Puerto Rico in particular, their energy generation was really in one specific part of the island. So that was kind of where the power was generated. And then they had poles and wires transmitting it to other population centers around Puerto Rico. That's the way we've been doing it in this country for the past century. That is not the most efficient way to get power. And when you do have extreme weather like that, it actually puts you more at risk for these poles and wires being knocked down by these events. So we're really thinking, how can we be part of a rebuilding solution now to make our energy grid more resilient, more reliable, and to put the consumer at the center of that? The future, a little bit more control here. So you can see a nice diagram of someone with their electric vehicle that's charging from the rooftop solar panels. Some Sunrun Brightbox storage over there. So this is something that we put together about a year ago at Sunrun when it was still just an idea to have a solar plus home battery product. We now have launched that in Arizona, California, and Hawaii, and have sold over 2,000 systems in California and Hawaii alone from the latest data that I saw. Again, kind of consumers having the optionality to have that level of control. And one other thing I would note is I think it's important that this diagram still shows the pole and the wire in the background. I don't know if anyone caught that. But we at, you know, Sunrun, and I think more broadly in the residential solar industry, absolutely still do see that solar can be a solution and work with some of the infrastructure that we do have. So, for example, Sunrun has partnered with National Grid on a grid services pilot. That's looking at how do we actually aggregate some of these resources that homeowners have invested in and then be able to provide demand response and capacity so that utilities don't need to be on the hook to build natural gas plants that, you know, are peaker plants, right, that we use a couple times a year. How do we actually aggregate these sources and then provide benefits to everyone on the grid? And that's some next level stuff that we have now whole teams at the company working on. So our states, as I said, we're in 22 states and Washington, D.C. One thing I would just underscore to Dan's point, I think there's been some, I'd say, more negative reporting on the industry as of late. And I think it's important to underscore that Sunrun, you know, expanded into multiple new markets last year. In total, the industry has grown, seven jobs in the solar industry have grown 17 times faster than jobs in any other sector of the economy. And Green Tech Media has suggested that by 2022, residential solar, so rooftop solar specifically, that capacity will triple. So we still absolutely see a just tremendous amount of opportunity for growth. Okay, and here's where I'll spend the bulk of my time to try to plant a few juicy little nuggets for where to look in the state of the states for solar here. So starting on the West Coast, as I mentioned, Hawaii and California are doing some really innovative work now, being able to bring on solar plus storage for customers and having that as a, you know, a kind of an available resource for people to tap into. California is interesting in that the policy there, I think, is actually going to allow for more solar plus storage on the grid. So California has transitioned to time-of-use rates, which essentially customers are charged more when there is a peak demand for energy. So that actually allows in California with the solar plus storage for us to automatically start charging someone to automatically start using electricity from solar or from the storage product and actually be able to keep people's rates down. So rather than pulling from the grid when energy is peaking and as it's at its most expensive during the afternoon, people can use what's stored in their system. And I think that's only going to accelerate this trend, particularly as all Californians transition to that rate in 2019. Right now, it's the three investor-owned utilities that are in the midst of transitioning for solar customers specifically. But by 2019, everyone will be on that rate. I would also just note that I find California, Hawaii, and then Massachusetts and New Jersey exciting for some of the work that Green Tech Media has done looking at these mature markets. So those four markets make up about 70% of residential solar capacity. When you look at kind of the populations of people who have access to solar in those more mature states where policy has been relatively stable for years and we haven't had to spend too many resources on fights there, they actually, when they extrapolate the results of a study they did in 2016, it shows that 100,000 low-income residents now have rooftop solar. So these are people making less than $45,000 a year, families making less than $45,000 a year. And that, again, is exciting to me as we think about how do we just make this more accessible to people. Briefly on Nevada, this is one of the most storied states, so I'm sure many of you have heard about 2015 when Warren Buffett's utility, NV Energy, that has a tremendous amount of political power in the state, like nothing I have ever seen in my advocacy career, was able to get to eliminate the fundamental billing mechanism of net metering for rooftop solar users. So briefly, net metering is giving customers fair compensation, full retail rate for the energy that they send back to the grid and share with their neighbors. This is a policy that's in about 42 states right now. When that policy was eliminated in end of 2015, Sunrun and about half a dozen other companies had to immediately close operations in the state, showing, you know, how vulnerable companies still are to bread and butter policy like that. Thousands of people lost their jobs. I had to go to our warehouse and help a lot of our employees pack up. And from there, what was exciting and kind of why I'm bringing it up is there was just an insane consumer, a tremendous consumer backlash to that. And we saw then the Nevada legislature meets every other year. In 2017, when they met this spring, suddenly solar was a top three issue that they were going to work on because there had been so much backlash. People saying, hey, I want the right to go solar. How did this happen? So the legislature actually reinstated net metering in June of this year. And they also did a first-in-the-nation solar bill of rights, which actually protects a consumer's right to self-generate and inoculates them from being able to have any fees put on them that are punitive, discriminatory because they are a solar user. It also helps with some interconnection time. So tremendous victory. I think that, you know, gave us a lot of confidence in the fact that we keep saying solar's probably pulls better than babies, right? And that's a great example of it. Stephanie, how am I doing on time? Oh, I've got 1 minute. Okay, quickly, I'd say Texas is a place to watch. Texas is a place, again, where we've kind of creatively partnered with a utility in a deregulated market to offer a NEM-like structure. This is very recent for Sunrun. There are a couple of utilities that are now trying to eliminate net metering in their areas, so we're going to be focusing there a lot. Happy to talk more about that. South Carolina is a place I want to just point to really briefly as well. South Carolina is actually in the middle of an energy crisis. I don't know if people have been following this, but the utility SCANA there that covers SCE&G for 9 years has been working to build two new nuclear reactors. They've spent $9 billion on this and raised rates for customers in the area 9 times to pay for this. In July, they decided that they actually were going to mothball the entire project, but that customers are still on the hook for paying close to $30 every single month on their utility bill for a project that will never be built and will never produce any energy. This is, in the meantime, we are facing some barriers to solar access there. When we instated solar net metering there with Governor Nikki Haley and a unanimous Republican legislature, solar went gangbusters. It was the fastest growing market in the country. There are now barriers there when there's an energy crisis. And, you know, all the data, Lawrence Berkeley National Lab put this out this year, shows that rates increase for customers due to capital expenditures like what I just spoke about and can decrease due to more solar on the grid. So, place to watch. Finally, Northeast is another place. Happy to speak with anyone about that afterwards. Governor Cuomo in New York is doing an incredibly thoughtful process through reforming energy vision that is going to allow for more solar and storage on the grid there. Same with Massachusetts, the smart incentive under Charlie Baker. Governor Charlie Baker is also going to allow for more solar and storage. So those are really exciting, optimistic places to watch. And look out for the Midwest, another growing market. So thank you. Thanks for letting me take a little more.
Thank you. And I know some of you also already had questions. I hope you're jotting it down. Save it to the end. We have just two more speakers. I know some of you, there was not enough time to go over, I think, Illinois and Florida. So if you've got questions on that, definitely bring them up later. So I'll turn it over now. We're going to switch, put our wind hats on, and move over to Peter Kelly, who's working for the American Wind Energy Association. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephanie. I wanted to mention the title of this program, something about Trump, I believe, and how renewable energy is going to survive and thrive during the Trump years. And I'm going to tell you about wind, but really wind is also a form of solar energy if you think of it. I mean, the sun hits the earth and moves the air currents around, and that creates wind energy. sometimes you hear and sometimes you even see written the phrase, yeah, but what about when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow? So I just wanted to look at that because we've solved the cost problem, as we'll get to further for wind. But and you can go to the first slide there. But now we're hearing a lot about reliability from the administration, and that's a current topic of discussion since last Friday. The Department of Energy suggested that we reward coal and nuclear for having on-site fuel storage in the name of grid reliability. So I wanted to look at that. But first, this statement. So who remembers when the sun didn't rise? There was a morning. You mean there wasn't? The sun rises every morning? Okay. And how about when the wind doesn't blow? That day when the wind didn't blow anywhere across the United States and everything was a dead calm. So you could actually go online. There's a wonderful wind map, and it shows the currents constantly circulating over the U.S. So the sun rises every morning. The wind's always blowing somewhere, and we're in 41 states now. And yes, we're cheap, but we're also increasingly a source of reliability on the grid. Wind and solar have diversified the grid and made it more reliable, not less. One of the things that's solved the cost equation is taller turbines, and we recognize that that now increases the view of turbines on the landscape. And so we'll have a challenge in the coming years to locate more wind turbines. And I encourage you to contact us and contact folks like Matt from DTE, who's about to speak, about communities that have welcomed the turbines because it's a cash crop for their farmers. It's a way for the farmers and ranchers to stay on the land and pass their land on to the next generation. It's a way for these small, economically distressed communities to get ambulances and new classrooms and to pay their teachers, literally. So we are increasingly offering the financial advantage not just to the companies that buy the wind power, but also to the landowners that host them and to the consumers that get the cheap energy and to the communities that get all the tax benefits. Next slide. And we are actually increasingly going to beat every other form of energy on the grid. Renewables are getting cheaper, while the long-term projections are that fossils will edge higher. Now, you know, your results may differ. This is a projection by the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, not from AWEA, and we'll see what happens in the future. But as you can see, wind prices are trending lower, and the band is the full range of prices, and the dots are the median price of wind energy over time. And it starts today, and it goes all the way out to the middle of the century. According to the Department of Energy, at mid-century, wind will be the leading source of electricity in America with about 35% of the grid. But you notice that's still a very diverse grid: wind, solar, some geothermal, some legacy coal and nuclear, and much gas will be on the grid. And so we'll still have a very diverse grid, but a lot more wind power, about five times as much as we have today. Next.
Just one question. I just want to interrupt one sec. Maybe Peter just explain the difference. I mean, we have a lot of big difference in price on here compared to your next slide, if you just want to clarify that. Sorry, let me just bring that down.
So this slide, the price along the side is dollars per megawatt hour, so it's how much is actually being paid for the electricity on long-term contracts, power purchase agreements. There, you'll also see a reference to the levelized cost of energy. Some graphs talk about levelized cost. That's kind of the all-in cost, but not counting the incentives that different forms of energy get. And so you can get results from Lazard and also from LBNL. The annual Wind Technologies Report every August will report out some levelized cost of energy comparisons. And that lets you do an apples-to-apples comparison across different forms of energy, not counting the incentive. As you know, the wind incentive is going away. The production tax credit that Chuck Grassley passed in 1992 and that really started to kick in the early 21st century, now we've had a huge growth in wind energy fueled partly by this tax credit. And we're now phasing that out. We're the first industry to go through tax reform, if you will. We've tax reformed ourselves. And so we're in year three of a five-year phase-out of the production tax credit. 2019 will be the last year you can start a wind farm and get any portion of that, and then it goes away. So let's keep moving. One of the reasons for the cheap prices is taller turbines and longer blades to capture more energy. The energy you get is the cube of the area swept out. And so as you increase the blade, you get geometrically more energy. And that's why even existing turbines are being refitted with longer blades. The towers are moving from 80 meters tall to 100 meters tall in some cases. And as you go up above 100 meters, you can see the whole southeast becomes available for wind development. So the wind doesn't blow as hard in the southeast. There's more trees there, among other things. And we haven't seen wind energy developed in the southeast to any extent. North Carolina got its first wind farm this year for Amazon Web Services. And as we get up higher, you get closer to the jet stream and you're accessing a higher wind speed the higher above the earth you go. And we're finding economical ways to light up the southeast with wind power too. So let's get to reliability, because that is key to this current national conversation we're having about whether renewables should now be disadvantaged in the face of coal and nuclear because we're somehow variable. They call us variable resources. Well, everything's variable on the grid. You know, a big fossil plant can turn off in a second, or you can have a gas pipeline go down in frigid weather, as happened during the polar vortex. And wind kept 5 million people with power in Texas during that polar vortex when other plants were shutting off. Wind changes gradually over time. It's predictable 4 to 24 hours in advance. We've got 35 years of experience in predicting how the wind energy is going to hit these turbines. And so it actually changes gradually and predictably in contrast to other plants that can immediately shut off. And even just the variation in people getting up at halftime of the Super Bowl and opening the refrigerator door causes a bigger variation on the grid than the momentary variations of wind and solar, right? And grid operators are used to accommodating for these huge swings in consumer demand. When they get home from work and turn on the air conditioners in hot parts of the country, that's a huge spike. And yet, wind and solar can help iron that out because basically we're generating and generating gradually in different amounts rather than suddenly in different amounts. So this is I think where we're getting our information from the people who run the grid and from the big utilities like Xcel or like DTE who are investing. And they said, we didn't think we could do this. We thought 25% was the limit. And now we're comfortable with 35, 50% even. It's not even our ceiling, says the guy who runs the SPP regional grid across 14 states, which regionally peaked over 60% wind energy. So we've got political benefits all around the country. That's going to help us because we have widespread factories as well as widespread wind farms. We're in 41 states with the wind farms. We're in about the same number of states with the factories. So every state has either wind farms or wind factories. And one thing I often say about getting through these next Republican years is that over 80% of wind turbines are represented by a Republican in Congress. So Republican House members have over 80% of the turbines. And I think they recognize the economic benefits. And almost 90% of the new wind farms are being built in states that voted for Trump. So one of the things that's a currency in this current administration is, can you create new U.S. factory jobs? And we will create 8,000 new U.S. factory jobs in the next 4 years, 2017 to 2020. That's the projected growth in wind manufacturing jobs. Over 60% domestic content. So, yes, there are some foreign parts, and, you know, it's a global industry. We import many things here for all industries. But over 60% of the value of a U.S. wind farm is made in America.
Just 1 minute, Mark.
Okay. So let's march through a few quick slides. These are people who work in the fastest-growing job in America, which is wind turbine technician. And this gentleman is in a rural area that's getting some of $85 billion in economic activity we're creating during the four-year period. The Trump administration's first term is 2017 to 2020, $85 billion in economic activity from wind. This gentleman is a welder in Minnesota, and he voted for Trump, and his helmet says, Make America Great Again, and he's welding wind turbine parts. That's a tower he's working on. And this family in Colorado Springs, which is a Republican stronghold, among other things, they've now have enough turbines on their land that it's passing to the fourth generation. You see the young men on either side, they're going to be the fourth generation operating that ranch in Colorado with the income from the turbines, whereas otherwise they were about to subdivide the land and sell it off. And here's Chuck Grassley, who I mentioned is the father of the production tax credit. This is taken from a campaign ad on top of the tallest turbine in America. It's 115 meters tall in Iowa. It's made out of concrete. And he went up there to the top to film his campaign ad. And the drone catches him as he goes over. And Chuck Grassley's not much of a liberal, but he's a great wind supporter. And we've got major brands, companies investing in wind in great numbers. So you see that's a major driver for growth as these companies say, we want wind energy to fulfill our renewable commitments, but mostly because it's just cheap electrons. And cities, too, are investing. So some of you who – you can go to the next one. Some of you who find a city council or a mayor may be now making a renewable commitment and fulfilling it with wind. And nearly 7% of the wind power in the country is now being sold to cities, including Pittsburgh and Chicago and Atlanta and San Diego and D.C. and many other cities are investing in wind. And then finally, I'll just land on what we need. We need more transmission lines. It's so important. We really ought to be called the American Wind Energy and Transmission Association because it's that important to renewable energy. If you're for renewables, you need to be for transmission because we need to hook up the cheap renewable energy we're making, often in the middle of nowhere, frankly, with the population centers that need cheap energy and are paying a lot more than they need to for their power. So by building more transmission, we can also build out the renewable energy. Let's see. And then this is the last slide. Of course, some of you will be covering the offshore industry. We have 52,000 turbines in America on land, and we have five offshore. So those five turbines are the beginning of something that will grow to hundreds and eventually thousands of offshore turbines. They're starting on the East Coast where they pay a lot of money for energy, and especially on Block Island. They made it with diesel oil, and they had some of the highest electric rates in the country, and now they're getting it from an offshore wind farm. So I'll stop there, but I'm happy to take your questions. Thanks.
All right, and our last speaker will be Matt Wagner from DTE. He covers renewable siting and development for DTE.
So thanks for being here, everybody. I got to say that I will never grab a beer from the fridge in the same way again after your comment about, you know, how much the load changes when that happens. Never really thought about that, and I'm a utility guy. So, again, my name's Matt Wagner. I'm the manager of renewable energy for DTE. I worked in the environmental arena, compliance, regulation, cleanup, and management for about 20 years, and then I had the privilege to move over to renewable energy about 10 years ago. And we've come a long way. DTE's come a long way, and I would say our most exciting news is our recent announcement. Well, let's just go to the first slide. Stephanie told me I was doing cleanup, so I'm going to be fairly brief on each of these slides. And since you're going to get them, you can look at some of the details at a later point. But just a little bit about DTE. We're among the largest utilities in the country. We've got two business units. One is DTE Electric, and that was established in 1903. That's about 2.2 million customers, and DTE Gas, which was established in 1849, which is just over a million customers for a total of about 3 million customers in Michigan. And our electric business is in southeast Michigan. Our gas business is really kind of statewide in various locations. So the next slide, please. And so the exciting news for us is Jerry Anderson, our CEO, about 5 or 6 months ago now, announced that we are embarking on an 80% carbon footprint reduction by 2050. That represents a long-term shift, and most of that shift will take place in renewable energy and natural gas. So next slide, please, Stephanie. Right now, we are the largest renewable energy producer in Michigan. We've got 13 wind parks, and that's about 50-50 owned and contracted wind parks. And about 31 solar facilities, and we'll zero in on one or two of these as examples later on. That's about 1,000 megawatts. That's about roughly a tenth of our load, and that powers just under about 500,000 homes. So we're pretty excited about that, and I'm happy to say that my team has kind of created this space, and so we're looking forward to doing more of that. DTE, through our renewable work, has driven about $2 billion in investments in Michigan and in companies that support the renewable growth in Michigan. And about a little more than 90% of that is wind energy. You know, wind right now, from an economic standpoint, is just the biggest bang for the buck in terms of renewable energy. So that's where we are right now. Let's go to the next slide, please. So our carbon reduction plan, it's about 4,000 megawatts renewable energy, a combination of wind and solar, and about 3,500 megawatts of natural gas. You know, our coal plants are getting old. I mean, we've got some coal plants that are decades old, and it's kind of like an old used car. My daughter's got a kind of a jalopy, and yes, she's happy to have a car, even though it doesn't look like much. But at some point, very soon, we're going to have to just get rid of it because it's just not making sense to pay for anymore. And in the same way, some of our coal plants are getting there. And we see all of our coal plants reaching that point at some time in the vicinity of 2040. Now, one of the things, you know, we all get the title of today's presentation. And so our leader has said, you know, we appreciate that Trump is trying to bring coal back in some ways, and right now a lot of our generation is coal, and it's been good for the state of Michigan. However, I think what our leader said is it doesn't make our coal plants any younger, and a utility has to think long term in terms of their planning. And so to have this late breaking news that, you know, they're trying to pull things back is just it doesn't affect us that much because we, out of necessity, have to be thinking long-term. And right now, long-term for us is renewable energy and natural gas. We also have nuclear, and I'm going to put a pie chart up there. We're also doing things. We're trying to invest in electric and our gas infrastructure, energy efficiency, and water conservation as well as part of this plan. So let's go to the next slide, please. And so this is a pie chart, and probably the takeaway from this slide is in 2005, about 80% of our generation was from coal. And in 2050, 0% we expect will be coming from coal. And again, it's mostly renewable energy, natural gas, and nuclear. So next slide, please. So here's just a couple of slides on some of our projects. The most recently completed wind project is the Pinnebog Wind Park. You see the picture there, which is actually a drone photo, again, of them putting the rotor onto the nacelle. Somebody up front earlier when Peter was talking was kind of struggling with dimensions. And what I like to tell people, our turbines are on the order, our hub heights or the sort of the power plant portion, the part that looks like a small bus on the top, that's at about 96 or 100 meters, which is a little bit more than the length of a football field if you took it and you stood it on end. That's how tall these things are, is a little bit bigger. And then when you add the rotors on there, the blades, you add another almost half of the height of the turbine again. So that's the size of these things. We're excited about the Pinnebog Wind Park. It was the 30-turbine project, 50 megawatts. We are in sort of the final stages of approval with the Pine River Wind Park that is being built for us by Invenergy up in northern central Michigan. It's 65 wind turbines. And then we are right now considering various projects for a future wind park. We're expecting to build that. We're hoping COD is or completion of that park is in 2020, and that's going to be about 150 megawatts. So next slide, please. Very excited about our solar. In the short term, we're not going to be doing a lot more solar, although long term, we expect that to change pretty significantly. But we're particularly proud of this array in Lapeer. It's 200,000 panels. It's 48 megawatts across 250 acres. And when you're there, when you're driving on I-69 and you see this thing, it just looks like a sea of panels. And, you know, some people might not care for that, but we think it's very exciting. And then we have one of the largest urban arrays. These solar folks may tell me I'm wrong, but we think it's one of the larger urban arrays in the U.S. It's 2 megawatts. It's called O'Shea Solar Park in Detroit. And the city was very excited to partner with us on that as well. So let's go to the next slide. Last thing I wanted to talk about is My Green Power, very briefly. This is a program that's actually the power for supporting this program is coming from the Pinnebog Wind Park and the O'Shea and Lapeer Solar Park. Basically, what this project, this program is, it's a way for people who either don't have the dollars or they can't support the infrastructure to do their own solar, so they can buy into solar. And so, if they want to, they can invest. There is a slight premium that they pay on their power, but you know, we found in particular folks in urban areas who just can't support a solar project for a variety of reasons, are very excited about this, and they know that their power, even though when electrons get on the grid, they all become kind of the same color, but they know that, you know, this is coming from two discrete projects, the Pinnebog Wind Park and Lapeer, and actually also O'Shea. So, Stephanie, that I'm going to stop there, and then we can get into questions and go from there.
Okay, I'm going to open it up. I'm going to leave about 20 minutes for questions. Did anyone in the audience want to start off first? Okay, we have a good amount. Okay, good, because I have a list of my own. I'm going to ask you, I will repeat your question as well, so just for the recording. So why don't we just start up here?
Tom Henry at the Toledo Blade. Matthew, so just for the record, maybe you could bring us up to date on what this all means for the Fermi 3 nuclear plant license that DTE has. It sounds like, even more than a couple of years ago, DTE is...
Yeah, well,
I'm just going to repeat the question first.
Okay, yeah,
so the question is just about, is it the DOE? No.
Fermi 3.
Oh, this updated status of the Fermi 3 nuclear license.
Right. So we did get approval for that license, and that we really did that as insurance because we didn't know which way things were going politically, and you know, there were a number of variables. So, I mean, we're expecting Fermi 2 to be operating for a long time. But I think what the company did was we said, you know, we don't know where things are going in terms of in a lot of ways. We would like to have this license for another nuclear unit if, in fact, we need it. In terms of when or if, I really can't tell you that. But the company made a decision to invest in getting that, because if you've done any investigation, it's getting one of these licenses is not a small effort, but we wanted to have that in the interest of our customers and in the interest of, you know, providing power in Michigan for the future.
As a quick follow, also, what does this mean for DTE's coal-fired power plant in Monroe, which is you guys put $1 billion into and has been, you know, was held up by George Bush?
Yeah.
For air emissions, is that going to be one that'll be retired by 2050?
Eventually, it will. Yeah. But it's a fantastic plant. It's one of the largest plants in the country. But at some point, you know, it will reach that point where it's just not cost effective to operate it anymore. So,
okay. Next question.
So when both of you are looking at policy.
The wind guys or the solar and the wind?
The solar and the wind. Both sectors looking at the Trump policy to privilege coal and nuclear and then add in the solar case with the ITC on the preference. You see it as hurting you. How do all of you see the coal nuclear preference as hurting or depressing your markets in itself, even aside from the trade case?
So for all panelists, the question is, how do you see the Trump policy that favors coal and nuclear impacting your respective areas? I'm just going to ask the guys, just announce your name before you answer, just so the recording knows who's answering for later. Obviously, people know who Lauren when Lauren speaks.
If I could just jump in for starters. So there is
Peter
no policy
first,
yet.
Right, Peter?
And we're not sure there will be. There seems to be a unanimous chorus against this idea that has been floated, which on Friday, Secretary Perry acknowledged it was a trial balloon or a place to start the conversation, I think he said. So DOE recommended that FERC take action. But FERC is, you know, quasi-independent, and I think they would probably say independent of DOE, and we'll see what they do. They have to have a case. And there is no case from our point of view. There's no emergency. In fact, grid reliability has been increasing, and that's certified by the North American Electric Reliability Corp. You know, NERC has just said that after a thorough review that the grid is more reliable. And it's not clear that anything called on-site fuel storage would do anything for reliability. You know, they're requiring 90 days of coal be on site. Well, coal plants don't even keep that much coal on site, so it's not clear they could even qualify.
I would just add to that, this is the least free market approach we could possibly take in this country. And for just a little context, right now about 70% of our energy infrastructure is nearing the end of its useful life. We spend about $90 billion of ratepayer dollars every single year on that infrastructure. This would raise rates, and who wants that? So I'm, you know, in Peter's camp on I do not see that this will hold muster.
Anyone else want to comment? Okay. We're going to move on to the next question. I'm going to do a few from the front, and then I will move to the back, so I appreciate patience in the back. Gentleman right here.
Yes, John Addison. Maybe, Peter, you can start this and the others can join in. You showed a slide of a lot of corporate procurement, which also is done, of course, in solar. Could you expand on the various ways corporates procure through utilities, outside utilities, beyond PPA? And is political uncertainty affecting finance costs and project time?
Okay, so the question is to Peter first on corporate PPA, which are power purchase agreements, looking beyond our customers using other ways to buy renewable energy, it sounds like. And the second question is looking at policy on whether that's impacting, is it customer interest to some extent? Customer financing of renewables.
So companies can buy renewables in different ways. Recently, we held a press conference at a General Motors factory in Texas that manufactures the biggest SUVs they've got, and it's going to be 100% wind-powered as of next year. Now, Texas, as most of you probably know, is a source of a lot of wind energy. A quarter of all the wind energy in America is made in Texas. And so that makes sense. They're right between Dallas and Fort Worth, though, so they're not immediately next to the wind farms. They will access that from the ERCOT grid. In other models, companies are using what are called virtual PPAs and other mechanisms to reach across state lines and buy the renewable energy they need, even if it's distant from their factories. So every bottle of Tide is now 100% wind-powered, and every bottle of Downy and Febreze and Mr. Clean and so on. Procter & Gamble made this commitment a couple of years ago, and they sourced the energy for four factories in North America from different places around North America. And so I encourage you to go to two of our member companies that specialize in being the middleman, if you will, to set up these deals. Altenex is one up-and-coming company out of Boston, and there's another called Renewable Choice. So there are some of the companies that specialize in these vehicles that allow companies to get the purchases they need. But when we have General Motors and Walmart, for instance, who were on a panel recently at our big conference, talk about why they're buying this renewable energy, we expected them to say something about, you know, our low carbon commitment and our customers demand it. And what they said is it's cheap. They said, I'm the guy that buys the electrons, and I buy the cheapest electrons I can get, and I'm getting them on a 20-year contract, and that's why I bought them.
Matt, I didn't know if you had anything else to add on that. You see customers day in and day out as well.
I think I have a pretty big... So can you guys hear me if I'm not speaking into the mic?
I think this is where the recording they're making.
Gotcha. Thank you. You know, what we find when businesses are coming to Michigan, they're interested in knowing these days that a good portion of the energy mix is renewable. So, you know, and are the politics in Washington affecting us? I think it goes back to what I earlier said is, our planning horizons are too big to shift every time something in D.C. changes. And so, you know, we're going that way, and we think it's a plus when companies come in and they want to develop. What I would say, and Peter and I were talking about this earlier today, the local politics are becoming more problematic to us. And I'm not even talking about the state of Michigan. I'm talking about community by community, as some folks – who aren't necessarily from those local communities have incentive to stir the pot and sort of oppose wind. And so that's where some, frankly, as a wind guy and a solar guy, more with wind these days, dealing with local opposition and opposition groups that kind of work in a state or in a region is really the politics that, you know, we're most challenged by. So
let's go right here.
Hi, Carolyn. Does that injury finding reflect any of the management practices of those two companies at all? And as that case moves forward, is there more opportunity to demonstrate that the management of those businesses played a role in their losses?
Okay, and I'm just going to repeat the question. The question is two-part, one on the injury part of the trade case for solar. Does that reflect the management of the two companies? And then is there, as the case moves forward, how is there opportunity for the management to... for the opposition to show that the management led to the injury.
I'll just answer that quickly and then pass it to Lauren. But we felt that the commission did not give adequate weight to the mismanagement in the injury phase. The injury phase is over. But certainly as the commission and as the president consider whether there should be a remedy, in particular for these two companies, the question is, what is it going to take to get these companies off the ground? And is there mismanagement a problem going forward? And given the fact that one of the companies is effectively defunct and the other one is barely functioning, the management problems that put them there cannot be ignored going forward as part of the remedy discussion.
I'll add briefly to that. This has been reported on in multiple outlets, but Suniva in particular, so this is the Chinese, majority Chinese-owned company, one of the two petitioners in this case, is backed by a firm, SQN Capital, that actually at the start of this all went to the Chinese Chamber of Commerce and said, we will make this all go away, to the tune of about $50 million and change. So there's a lot of opportunities for us still to say, this is mismanagement. This is actually fundamentally abusing the trade laws. This is about bailing out some corporate backers for this. So you will continue to hear those arguments. You'll also just, in this phase, the downstream job impact is of particular importance to the commission. So you'll hear a lot of those legal arguments and a lot of those arguments with the press as well of, you know, as Dan said, this would potentially wipe out about a third of the industry and be also detrimental to American manufacturing jobs as well.
All right, we'll move to the back. Thanks for being patient. Let me start with this gentleman in the suit.
Justin Curtis, freelancer from California. I'm curious, there's an effort at tax reform underway in Washington, GOP effort. Do you see any threat in that effort at existing tax incentives for, you know, the December 2015 clean energy tax incentives, and some speculation that the White House might want to try to rescind those
tax extenders. So what are you hearing about threats to clean energy?
Okay, so a question for all the panelists, tax reform and how that's going to impact any kind of clean energy taxes like production tax, investment tax credits.
This is Dan Witten. I'll jump on that first, only to say that Peter mentioned in his prepared remarks that we've already been tax reformed. We all have. We have a deal that was a bipartisan deal, strong Republican support, that called for the scaling back of our incentives. And so our hope and belief is that there's enough support on the Hill for our ramp down to keep that deal, hold the deal, and not include that in a tax reform package. And certainly then there's the question of, you know, are they going to be able to get a big package through, and what does that look like? So there's a lot still to be determined on tax reform.
And that deal was one of the most successful tax policies of recent years. I mean, it has galvanized a lot of economic growth, as you've heard from both of our industries. So as they go to try to get votes for a tax reform package, they'll be looking for things that increase political support for the final deal, not decrease political support. And I would say any attempt to reopen that deal would decrease political support, because we've got bipartisan, you know, support and benefits all across America at stake. So certainly the business community does not want to have a retroactive tax increase on any industry, including wind in my case. So we'd be against a retroactive tax increase, and we think we'd have a lot of company.
Yeah, before I turn to the next question, the other argument we read about in the news is how with tax reform, as businesses get taxed presumably less, that there will be less appetite to some extent for these credits that are financing the renewable projects. So these renewable projects can sell these credits presumably to people that also want to reduce their tax burden. But if companies in general have a less tax burden, that's the other argument that's been circling around in the media as well. So next to him, the woman right there. Yep. How many solar manufacturers in the U.S., and where do they stand on their position on the case?
Yeah, this is Dan, and this is one of the things that has been the biggest challenge to kind of unwind. There are more than 600 solar manufacturing facilities in the United States, and the other side wants you to think that their narrow little piece of the manufacturing pie is all manufacturing. They manufacture panels and cells. Even at the end of last year before this trade case, they represented 2,000 jobs compared to 36,000 jobs in other parts of the manufacturing supply chain. So you have your steel, your racking units, you have your trackers, inverters, wiring. All of this, your electricity components, all of this is manufactured right here in the United States. And if these two companies prevail, there are some other cell and panel manufacturers in the U.S. First Solar is a big one. They don't do CSPV, so they're not covered by this case. Tesla's working on a big factory in Buffalo. There's smaller ones like Mission and Auxim that also do it. But this case will hurt the vast, vast majority of American manufacturing jobs and manufacturers.
Can I put a quick fine point on that? The statistic that my chairman uses, and he's testified in front of the commission twice now, is this would be detrimental to 98% of solar manufacturing jobs in this country. Bailout for two companies at the detriment of 98%.
The storyline, you know, you know, as a former journalist, we all wanted to say, you know, what the conflict is, and conflict is great. But the idea that this is manufacturing versus, installers or whatever is patently false. It's wrong. And so you have to be a little bit more sophisticated and tease out what jobs they're actually talking about. And I think that's that would be, you know, from our perspective, that's really important. It's a challenge that we would put to all journalists. And we've had to follow up and say, look, you know, this is not couched in the right way. It's so.
You have a question from Ian E. All right, so the question is about, again, trade case. What's the next step if the two companies, Neva Solar World, get what they want?
You want to start on this one? Hi, Alan. Well, we certainly move into, you know, the next, you know, mode. We're still going to continue to do the best we can to market, sell, produce our products. We want to make a difference in the electricity mix. We're going to continue to do that. Projections show that we will climb out of the hole a little bit, but not nearly to the extent that we would without that. So it'll be two tracks. I mean, the next phase is up to the rest of the world. Another country has to file a claim with the World Trade Organization, and there's precedent for that. They did it in the last anti-dumping and countervailing duty case. So we fully expect some country or countries will complain to the World Trade Organization, and at that point, you know, we've got to continue to make money and earn people's business while that process unfolds.
Just for the recording, that was Dan. So next question, right here, this gentleman up front. Okay, the question is, can you comment on these companies being foreign-owned and just how can we be having this kind of case, I guess, with – all right, good.
I think
– say your name.
Dan Whitten. I think there's sort of two different answers to that. I mean, I think it's important that we not demonize, you know, companies based on where they're from. This is a world market. It's an international market. Some of our members are owned by – people overseas, so it's not that they're foreign that's the most galling. It's that they're draping themselves in a red, white, and blue flag. They're using American trade law to basically demolish an industry, and they happen in Solar World's case. They're 48% owned by the Qatari Sovereign Wealth Fund. In Suniva's case, they're primarily Chinese owned, and as Lauren said, their hedge fund company, which is $60 million in the hole, is just trying to get their money back. So it's the dynamic, it's the way the argument's being made, and the fact that these foreign companies are draping themselves in American flags, that's the real hypocrisy there. And so, again, it's not just that they're foreign owned.
I'm just going to go to the gentleman in the shirt in the back.
Bryce Gray from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. My question is mostly for you, Matthew. I was wondering with your company's renewable commitment here, or carbon emissions commitment, is there a realistic mechanism that utilities would buy into to accelerate the retirement of coal plants that might not be competitive with new wind, for instance, even though utilities in many cases are paying for these plants or have them in their plans for decades to come?
Let me just repeat the question. So your question is, from a utility perspective, would they ever close the coal plants as they're trying to accelerate renewables? Is that – okay. Or what's driving some of your – I think that goes to a broader question. What's driving your portfolio change? How do you make those decisions – as you're adding, a key part of that obviously is that 10% renewable, which is now 15% renewable standard in Michigan. Looks like that's what's driving it, but can you comment on that? Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, just briefly, you know, you do your best to plan for the future. There's a lot of drivers for how we supply power. Cost is pretty big. It's not the only thing, but cost is big. And one of the reasons is because we have an obligation to our customers to provide power in an affordable way. And so we're going to do that thoughtfully and carefully. I mean, honestly, I admire our leadership because they're saying we're going to make this commitment, but we're going to do it in a way that makes sense. And a lot of folks here don't realize that, you know, we're a regulated state in terms of all of our generation has to be approved by the state Public Service Commission. And so we have to be thoughtful about that and make sure that we're keeping our rates for our customers affordable. And, you know, that's just something we have to do step by step. So at this point, I can't really say more than that. I think the one thing we're trying to do is learn from others. We've looked at Germany and what happened in Germany. I mean, I have family in Germany, and they have a vision that's incredible for renewable energy. However, Germany moved really fast in terms of implementing renewable energy, and it actually caused them inadvertently to go rapidly back to coal. And so we're just trying to be as thoughtful as possible to do the right thing for the environment, but also to keep rates fair and affordable for customers.
We have time for one more question, so I'm going to... Okay, the question's on transmission for Peter to start on wind. What federal requirements are needed to boost that transmission? And same for solar, any need for transmission?
Well, the action starts at FERC. They have something called Order 1000 that was helpful in cost sharing across all the beneficiaries. So it's like building a superhighway. You don't want just the person at the end of the superhighway to pay for the highway. Everybody along that highway is going to benefit, and everybody along the transmission line benefits from billions of dollars of savings per regional grid per year that where these lines are being built. And SPP and MISO, those big grids that I was talking about, they both study this, and they find 4-to-1 ratio of benefits to the costs. And that's not even including the economic spinoff benefits and the clean air benefits. That's just ratepayer savings. So FERC will continue to be very important, and that's something to watch. But in addition, I would say there's an infrastructure bill that we've been told about. President-elect Trump said that this could include, you know, power lines, basically, and the Trump Transition website, even on their infrastructure page, it was a big picture of a transmission power line. And that's that. Notion occurs in both the Democratic and the Republican platforms, and a lot of people's vision for an infrastructure bill would include grid enhancement, let's just say that. So those are two places where there could be action. There's also I'll add one more thing. There's also the concept that of backstop siting authority, so that like other infrastructure that goes across state lines, such as pipelines, we would be able to build these with federal say-so because it's an interstate commerce issue. And Secretary Perry said a couple of weeks ago something along that lines, that he thought they should use their authority to get energy infrastructure built across state lines.
I don't know, Dan, if you had anything else to add. Or rooftop generally is on top of your roof, so we don't usually talk about transmission there. We talk about just distribution wires. But big solar, I don't know if you have anything else to add, whether it really needs more transmission at all.
Well, Lauren may have some thoughts on this. But transmission is fuel neutral, and, you know, if you build it, you'll get some more projects done along that transmission line. In fact, that's one thing the solar developers look at when they're looking at utility scale is where can I connect. So, you know, we're with AWEA on this one for sure. Yeah. That was Dan.
Nice. Yeah, I would just add, as Stephanie said, part of the benefit of rooftop solar, of course, is that that you can cut down on some of the expenses of traditional energy infrastructure, absolutely needed for the grid. But that's one thing that we think a lot about. And I would just say, since I didn't get to speak about Illinois, that's a piece of legislation in 2016 that Energy Future Jobs Act, where that was a with the RPS there, 25% renewable portfolio standard. What was changed in that is rather than just having the utilities get to meet that by renewable energy credits, there actually had to be building in state of a diversity of clean fuels. So wind, large-scale solar, rooftop solar, community solar, and part of that is also an effort to just make sure that we can meet this commitment with in-state build and keep prices down, because rooftop solar, you know, can accomplish that from a grid infrastructure point of view as well.
All right. We are going to have this coffee break now, so before the next panel at 10:45. One item, though, is I did post on the WOVA app, if any of you downloaded the app, under this panel I pasted basically a guideline sheet that has some background stories on the trade case, on the DOE Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, if you already don't know enough about it. And then there's just some links for beginner reporters on, I know Lawrence Berkeley National Lab was mentioned, there's some good sources. So I put links and things on the page, so to try and open it and let me know. And we'll get the presentation posted as well. All right, thank you. Oh, and